Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we're going to talk to a really fine thriller writer. Her name is Lisa Gardner, and she's a New York Times bestselling author now. And her new book is called Live to Tell. How are you?
I'm doing well, David. Thanks for having me again.
This is I don't know how to describe this book. You really went to some dark places in this book, but it's really quite riveting to read. I mean, it's really quite, it just grabs you. I think at first I was, you know, it doesn't hit you at first, and then this is how I felt. I don't know how all my readers are going to feel about this, but I found that the more I went along, the more unsettled I got by the whole book. Was that your intention?
Yes. I mean, the book's a little bit of a departure from me. On the one hand, it's a straight police procedure. It features the return of my normal character, Boston Detective Dee Dee Warren, and at first blush, it looks like we're kind of, you know, traditional crime scene novel territory.
Right.
She is called out to investigate the scene of what appears to be a family annihilation. Father has, you know, murdered his family before attempting to take his own life. He's in critical condition. Except then the exact same thing happens again. And the scenes are just too unsettling close in process to believe that they were random coincidental acts. And all the roads start to lead you to this lockdown pediatric psych ward where there works a nurse whose own family was killed 25 years ago, and she is the only survivor who's lived to tell. So you kind of start out with, okay, all right, it's going to be some cool little murder mystery about family annihilations. And then the next thing you know, you're in a lockdown pediatric psych ward, you know, with seven-year-olds who hear voices in their heads to do terrible things.
And I just felt like you must have gone to a psych ward to see the kids, like, for the book. I mean, because
in my personal life, I have long been active with at-risk and special needs kids. It is one of the passions that's close to my heart.
So this is something that was in the back of your mind to write about, and just you were just waiting for the right moment?
Actually, what ended up happening, and it's a little bit sad and touching, and again, a little bit of a departure. All my books have been based on real true crime, but this was something that actually happened in our community. One of the mothers that works in this organization with me, she like disappeared for 6 months. And when she came back, and we're all like, oh, good to see you again, where have you been? She just started talking. And for the next hour, she poured out what happened to her family over the summer when her 8-year-old son experienced a psychotic break and did attack the babysitter of the house. They had to rush home. They had to get him sedated. They had to rush him to this exact same lockdown pediatric psych ward where I went to visit and interview the caretakers and spend some time. And he seemed to be stable. They got him home. He suffered a break again, went violent again. They had to go back down. And just, I think we have a preconceived notion in our head that bad kids do bad things. It was so interesting for me to hear the story of their son is actually an amazing child. He has empathy. He has a conscience. He is raised by good, engaged parents who love him a great deal, but he is mentally ill. And from the time he was very young, he has heard voices telling him to do very dark things.
That's pretty scary to even contemplate. I mean, you can't imagine what that would be like to go through, and yet...
Yeah, as a mother, I found it completely compelling, and partly is I thought more people need to know this experience. You know, we get these sensational crimes that captivate, you know, like the world's attention, and we have a tendency to marginalize them because it makes us feel safer. Like, you know, people don't take care of those kids, or they're just bad seed, and it's like... That's sometimes an assumption. Really good kids can do bad things, and it's called mental illness. And unfortunately, we're seeing it in record numbers these days, and we're not talking about it, and there are not enough tools and resources available. And that, as a parent, really fixated me, because I think in all my novels, what I've been trying to explore is essentially the nature of evil. And this is also one more answer to that question, because I think there are many faces of evil. But this is the one we probably talk about the least, which is good people who do bad things.
There are some graphic scenes in this novel, but I say there, I don't mind it, because I always love the way you write, the way you take me into these characters, and you make them all, everybody seems so believable, and I love Dee Dee Warren. All of a sudden, she'll just insult the suspects. I love that. I love that. You never know what's coming out of her mouth next. I don't think she even knows.
I love her. good alter ego. You know, writers, we're generally fairly quiet, introverted people, so we always write these really tough, wise-ass characters. They say all the things that we in real life would never have the courage.
But you're not afraid to really push the button, to really tell a compelling, graphic, hard-to-read at times story.
I mean, I have to say, it's the first rule of writing. You don't want to tell someone something's horrifying. You want them to feel it.
Right.
And in this book, I want you to feel what it's like being a mother, loving a seven-year-old so much, and wondering if this is going to be the night he kills you. But I also want, I think thrillers at their best. What I'm always looking for as a reader, so this is what, you know, I'm trying to do as a writer when I'm sitting down with a book like Live to Tell. I want the problem solving. I want characters that are being horrified and terrified and overwhelmed. But I don't want them whiny and bitchy and, oh, woe is me.
Right.
I want, and this is what I'm going to do about it. And this is how I'm going to seize control of my life. And this is how I'm going to get to the other side. And I think if you do that, you can have a really visceral book. Because at the end of the day, it's also about the fight back. It's about the empowerment. It's about what this mother and this father and what Detective Dee Dee Warren figures out using her investigator skills that, at, you know, this sounds trite, but saves the day.
Well, you have, especially Dee Dee, but a lot of your characters are very complex characters. They're not easy. They're not easy characters because you don't really know what they're going to do next. I mean, Dee Dee is a very sexual woman, and
yes.
And at the weirdest times, she suddenly gets sexual. And
yes.
Usually, when you read these kind of books, it's always this, they follow a pattern. You know, she's attracted to somebody, and they have sex, and then they fall in love, and they can't live without it. And it's that same pattern. But with you, she has these different people that she suddenly finds herself attracted to, and I find that interesting. That
I think of Dee Dee, she has a lot of testosterone.
Yeah.
I kind of envision her in many ways. She's one of those women that's kind of a half guy. I mean, she's very action-oriented. She's most comfortable being physical, whether that's the way she interrogates a suspect, the way that she approaches a scene, and like a lot of really physical, action-oriented people, yeah, she is kind of lustful as well.
Right.
You know, it's kind of a natural outpouring of the way she experiences the world, which is she is not quiet, demure.
Well, that's what makes the series more likable, when you don't know what's going to happen next, when you can't figure out that she's going to fall in love with this guy, and you see who she's going to be attracted to. And I don't know who this woman's going to end up with. I'm not sure she'll end up with anybody.
Well, if you want to know a secret, the next book, she starts out pregnant.
Oh, my.
Yeah, she's horrified.
Are we allowed to tell people that?
She's horrified. Look, it's basically page two, you figure it out. I mean, really, what the next book about is her trying to figure out, I mean, this is a woman, a detective, that doesn't have a maternal bone in her body.
I really look forward to your books. Do you know that?
Yeah. Poor Dee Dee Warren, because I so torture her.
I'm saying I really look forward to every one of your new books, because I never quite know where they're going at first, and then I realize, oh, they're going someplace I really like.
Oh, thank you.
And then I feel comfortable with it, and then all of a sudden I'm thrilled, you know. And that's what you want the reader to feel. You want the reader to feel like they're really getting their money's worth, and they're really getting a really good story.
What I really like with a thriller, again, both when I'm reading it and then when I'm trying to write it, I want that story that sweeps you away. I think most of us have really complicated, busy, kind of stressful lives. And at the end of the day, when we finally get to curl up with a good book, we want to be transported. I mean, and maybe that's why my books get a little graphic and a little visceral. I don't want you thinking about your life when you're reading this book. I want you so immense and fixated and horrified about something fictional, something safe, because you know what didn't really happen? That you can give up your normal everyday worries for a while and be, oh, that poor Dee Dee Warren.
Yeah. And before you know it, you're just totally involved in this book, and that's exactly what you did so well. It's interesting because we're talking to you on the day that your book comes out, the 13th of July, and
yes.
That, which is very unusual. I don't usually talk to the author on the same day the book is out. That doesn't happen very often at all. So yeah. I find it very interesting to do that because it's just becoming available today in all the bookstores. But I also know that you won an award for The Neighbor.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was very excited. Last week was the annual Thriller Fest convention, which is put on by the International Thriller Writers.
How many authors attend those things? That particular
one. It's a big conference. And it's big name authors. I mean, Lisa Scottolini was a guest of honor. Harlan Coben was a guest of honor. Gail Linz, the queen of espionage, was one of the guests of honors. We had Ken Follett, was our grand master.
Oh, he must be a cool guy. Did you get to meet him?
I just got to shake his hand, but Pillars of the Earth is like one of my favorite books. So I was practically levitating at the time. I was so excited to meet him. So it's a really great group. If you are a suspense mystery reader at all, I mean, this is such the convention, the conference to attend. And, you know, the end of it, every Saturday, they pick the best thriller novel. And I was really stunned that it was, and really honored that it was The Neighbor, which was the Dee Dee Warren novel that came out last year.
And you were up against some really tough competition, too.
I was. It was Joe Finder was up for Vanish, which was a fabulous novel. Linwood Barclay for Fear the Most. I actually blogged on that book. I loved it so much.
Right.
And there was Jefferson Parker for The Renegades and Harlan Coben for Long Lost.
That's a tough competition. I mean,
I really thought it was the dark horse in the category, and I had thought of nothing to say. It was quite the surprise, and I have to say, one of the highlights of my career. I mean, what a great evening.
Now, on your books, every time I see your books in the back, you always will hear you're very tall. How tall are you, anyway?
I'm only 5'4".
Oh, really? You're sitting on a stool in the back of this book that I have.
Well, that book, yeah, because of the stool thing, and sometimes at the conferences, like I have to say, at the moment, I'm wearing 3-inch heels, so that really helps.
Oh, right now you're wearing 3 inches.
Well, you caught me on book release day. My family took me out, so I have to say this is probably the first interview I've done in the comfort of my own home and cocktail wearing heels.
Right. Well, you're such a nice lady, too. I remember talking to you before and how nice you were. I mean, and I guess people think, wow, how does somebody nice like that write such a dark book? And what would you say if somebody asked you that?
You know, I'm always looking for answers. I mean, that to me what it's all about. For whatever reason, and it's definitely not a lighthearted subject, but I am fascinated by why do bad things happen. And for me, writing books, I'm not pessimistic and I'm not scared, but I want to better understand, you know, all these cases that make the nightly news. You know, this poor boy missing from Oregon. I mean, especially in this day and age of mass media, we're saturated with these cases that are riveting and horrifying.
And why do some of them get in the limelight and a lot of others don't? That's also fascinating.
I think that's a great question. And I think one of the things that's really frustrating in the real world is you never get the answers you want. So one of the joys of writing fiction, where I get to interview the experts and I get to control all pieces of the puzzle, is at the end of the day, okay, a terrible crime happened, such as Live to Tell, where all these families died. But at the end of the day, you get to know why. You know, in the real world, we never can fully say we know why, and that's just frustrating some days.
And what you were saying before, you made a point about the fact that it starts out with, it's just a police procedural at first, and
yeah.
I'm thinking now, boy, if it had just stayed that way the whole book, it would have been very boring. It would have been a very boring book, and then I'm thinking, well, if the father's guilty, then it really is, I mean, where's the story going to go from there?
Yeah.
So the fact that it goes in different directions really, really helps it out. Now, but you knew that ahead of time. You knew you were going to do that ahead of time.
Yeah, one of the things for me, because, I mean, I've been a published author now for 20 years. This is all I've ever done. I've written nearly 30 novels. So when I sit down to write, I need something fresh for me. I mean, you're going to spend, like, you know what, 2 nights reading this? I'm going to spend a year writing it. I want something that's fresh and interesting.
Is that hard to do for you, or do you really struggle with it?
So far, no. There's always some kind of case that catches my eye or something that comes along, like my friend and her very personal story, that opens up a whole new area. You know, I didn't know about that. I hadn't heard of that happening before. And bingo, you know, my little writer's mind is off and running. And I'm very lucky. A lot of suspense authors have some kind of expertise in their background. Like, you know, Tess Gerritsen, you know, she was a medical doctor writing medical thrillers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very much beholden to the experts that take the time to return my calls. And often I'm even cold calling. I'm an author. This is what I'm working on. I understand that you're an expert in this field. Could I have 1 hour of your time to answer some questions? And I'm really amazed and humbled to this day how many people, I think they kind of think it's funny, they've not had many authors call them up.
Right.
Say, oh, sure, you can come and do research at the Body Farm. Sure, you can tour our prison in Boston if you really want to. And, I mean, even the lockdown pediatric psych ward for Live to Tell, for me to comfortably bring that kind of location to my readers, I need to go there. I don't want to just hear a story about it. I want to be there, and I want to interview those nurses and the Malou counselors and see the kids. And it was really intimidating research to do as a mother. I have to say, it's one of the only things I've ever tried to do that my husband was kind of like, I don't know if you should. I think it'll be very depressing. I'm worried about you going there. And yet they were like, we would love for you to come. We need more people to realize the work we do. We need more people to know the stories we have to tell. And when I got to spend the day there, I mean, the children were amazing. The caretakers were really, I mean, these are the heroes among us. I found it to be actually the most uplifting experience because, yes, there are these kids with these terrible, terrible diseases, but look at these phenomenal people who've dedicated their lives. And let me tell you, it's not for a lot of money. I mean, it really is a passion.
Right. It has to be. They don't do it for the money.
Exactly. And, I mean, I have to say, I went into something expecting it to be actually really dark, and by the time I was done with the research, I was really heartened. I mean, we're very lucky in Massachusetts to have this kind of state-of-the-art pediatric care facility. We've come so long since the dark ages where even small children, if they heard voices, you know, were just tied down. You know, they don't do any of that anymore. They really work with the kids. And I can't tell you, I don't even know sometimes how to put it into words, how amazing it was to interact with the kids, because they really were kids.
Huh.
They were excited to have a guest on the ward. They brought me the pictures they had drawn. They wanted to show you pictures. They wanted to know why I was there and what I was doing. I, like, didn't even know what to say. And the head nurse was like, just talk to them. So I'm like, well, I'm an author. I write books. They thought that was hysterical. They brought me books.
Right. I love to hear the reaction of I wish we had about one of those nurses here right now who could talk to us and tell us what they thought of your book, because it's got to be pretty realistic. Because
I get to do a benefit for them tomorrow night at the Porter Square Bookstore in Porter Square in Massachusetts, which is by Cambridge, and I'm very excited to do that for them. You know, they gave me a lot of their time. They were very patient. It's obviously kind of technical, and I did send them the advanced reading copy because of the kind of book it was. I wanted to make sure they were comfortable with everything, so they actually vetted the novel, too, which I don't generally do, but I felt in this case was very important. And it will be very nice to do an event in their honor, because they really do fabulous work. And
it's not a job anybody can do, either.
Oh, my goodness, no. I wouldn't have had the patience for it, I have to tell you.
I mean, if I had to open somebody's heart, do open-heart surgery, this country would be in trouble, because I couldn't do it. But thank God there are people who can and do it. And the people that scare me are the ones that are real morbid about it and who will describe in detail what they do and get kind of weird pleasure out of that. That's what freaks me out.
What I got from these people that I so appreciated was how much they genuinely loved and respected and valued the kids.
Right. Well, that's the important thing. I mean, if they don't do that, I mean, what kind of a nurse could they ever be?
One of the things they taught me, too, that I think is important to bear in mind, and I don't dwell on this stuff in the book because the book has to entertain.
Right.
One of the things I really got out of it is sometimes as adults we look at kids and we want to fix them. And they're like, you're not fixing them, because that by definition almost tells the child there's something wrong with them. What you want is to help the child be the best child he or she can be. And some of that is even just creating moments throughout the day for an angry child to feel calm, for a sad child to feel happy. The children really live in the moment. They don't need some caretaker to come in and solve the world. They need a caretaker to come in and give them these moments. And those moments are extremely powerful for them. And I've held to that ever since they told me that really is the secret with kids, and particularly at-risk kids and special needs kids, is we don't have to fix everything for them and we don't have to make the world perfect. We just have to give them moments. And that means everything to them.
I must admit, reading this book, I had no idea that there were places like this and the horrible, you know, what the nurses must go through and the counselors and what they, that their life is in danger, basically, working there.
Yeah, well, and I did that scenario as accurately as possible, and they tell me I did well. There's really one child that is the most dangerous to them, and that's the prototype I kind of use, the archetype for Lucy, who is the primal child. Like, most of the kids, it's not so bad, but the primal children are everyone who had a bad incident, something, you know, physical that happened to them or attack on the job, that was the kind of child they were trying to deal with. Because his children are just so terribly, terribly damaged.
Okay. Now, could you ever do a job like that?
No, not in a million years.
You have how many children?
I only have one, and she runs circles around me.
Right. Now, how old is she?
She's about to go into second grade. She is very wonderful. She's very precocious. And,
Is she as pretty as her mother?
Thank you. You're very kind. I have complete strangers stop me in the grocery store to tell her how beautiful she is, which I have a couple opinions on.
Right.
I mean, I'm happy for her sake, but I'm not so sure that's what you want your child hearing all the time.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know. Yeah. In fact, the JonBenet Ramsey thing, you know, with the beauty pageants and everything, and those poor kids, when mothers put them through, you know, and you know, they mean well, but what do they really know what they're doing to their children? That's the question.
She's more the tomboy. She's the tough cookie, so she's funny. She's her father. They're both adrenaline junkies. They're happy when they're doing something that scares me.
And I must admit that the opening scene, one of the opening scenes with the alcoholic father is the most riveting thing I think I've ever read. I mean, I'm reading this thing and I'm instantly hating this guy.
Yeah.
And just feeling, and that's what I love about your books, the fact that I read them and I instantly relate to the characters and I just feel like I'm going through, I mean, I got so angry reading some of the things in this book.
Oh, good. Good for you.
Some of the scenes that just make you so angry and you, even the mother, the way the mother is, you know, well, I don't want to go into too much detail because I'll give something away, but knowing me, I probably will. Because, you know, after you read a book, you can't wait to talk about it. I'm just gushing with all this stuff.
Oh, nice.
I'm wanting to do it, and I can't do it because people haven't read the book. But the way the mother treats the child, Evan, is really horrifying at times. And is that the way a lot of mothers do it?
I wouldn't say that. I would say, you know, having a mentally ill child is such a personal and unique experience. And I really made Victoria up. I didn't have a lot. I mean, I really kind of went to just one person trying to deal with it. And I think you see how much she loves her son, and that's so interesting and so compelling. And yet she does make poor choices. But I'm hoping that when you read it, you understand why she does some of the stuff she does. I mean, she is burnt out. I mean, one of the things I found really riveting when I did the research is if you have a special needs child, there's just no respite workers in the U.S. They're incredibly hard to find. So you have kids, you can't leave the grandparents, you can't leave with the teenager down the street. I mean, these parents have the highest burn job in the country, and they can never get a vacation. You know, it's 24/7.
Oh, that's sad. That really is, because they need it.
I mean,
if anybody needs it, they do.
Yeah, you know, the organization I work with up here, that's one of the things, you know, we're trying to figure out is how we can do more respite training. But, I mean, that's a high burn job, and a lot of people, they become trained, and then they just burn out on it. So I think it's something that's very hard to ever catch up with a community. You're always going to need, if people out there, you know, bad economy, you want a job, train to be a respite worker. There's a huge demand. There's never enough of them.
And it's interesting, because people come in the store, and I tell them what the book's about. Sometimes the subject matter will turn them off. But you have a job as a writer to make it seem as realistic as possible, which means you sometimes have to put things in there that may be not popular, right? I mean, I can't imagine people really have that much trouble with the book, because it is such a great thriller. I mean, but you know what? You can't tone it down, or it just becomes false, and people start to realize, well, this isn't realistic.
Well, it becomes bad writing. Now you're telling people something. I mean, again, if you're writing something, you need to show them.
Right.
And I'm trying to give you a slice of life. I'm trying to show the reader. If anything, I hope the reader gets to the book and can at least go, "Wow, glad that's not me." No, I feel really good about my kids right now. I feel really good about my husband
And that's an interesting point, because I look at it that way, but I also look at it as this could happen.
Yeah.
This could happen to anybody.
All my books are based on reality, sadly, because people say you write such shocking novels, and I'm like, it's disappointing then how much reality went into it, didn't it?
And maybe I'm being a little negative by thinking that, but you can't help but think, what if that were me? What would I do?
Yeah. I think everyone does that when they read a book. I mean, I think that's part of the conversation starter. I mean, I'm trying to get you to empathize with other people.
And why does why would the father leave? And you, and right away you think, what an awful guy to leave his child. But,
yeah,
you know, when you start to realize what he's going through,
yeah,
and why he did it, and it doesn't seem as crazy anymore.
Well, I guess I'm trying to get you to see, here's a situation where there's no good answer. I mean, he has his reasons. I mean, he's also trying to do what he thinks is best for his family. And here's this mom trying to do what she thinks is best for the family. And they don't agree. But they're in such an intense situation, it's not unrealistic that they have very different solutions. I mean, actually, the hardest thing for my friend for what they went through is, yes, they had a child who had violent episodes. And it's hard to say he's violent and a bad kid, because he wasn't, but he had violent episodes. And yes, they had a younger sibling. And that is one of the toughest scenarios for so many of these families, is at what point are you jeopardizing your other children? And I have to say, as a parent, I just don't even begin to know how you parse that apart. I mean, that to me is the single worst thing that you can face as a parent, when you're having to meet one child's needs at the expense of the others.
Right. I hope you don't. I'm not upset that I'm talking about the graphic novel. I mean, the graphicness of your novel.
Yes.
But you know, I feel a need to bring it up because it's something that I like to get your reaction to. And people know. I think people who read your books know what they're going to be like anyway. So they're familiar with how you write.
Yes.
So they're not necessarily afraid of any of that. I get lots of women that come in the store and love, don't mind blood and gore, don't mind, not that your novels are very gory, they're not. I wouldn't say they ever go over to the gore, the really, really gory.
Like visceral.
Visceral. That's a better word. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. I guess it brings to life something that, you know, maybe isn't late. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but anyway.
It's an intense reading experience. People who want to read at arm's length and, like, know they're reading while they're reading. I feel my books, yeah, I mean, the more graphic, the more grab you by the throat, more you have to be totally immersed in this world right now. And some of the scenes that are happening aren't going to be ones that you love.
And I think a lot of people that would say that they don't want to think that this stuff really happens. So they kind of like have like blinders on, like, I don't know, this doesn't really happen. This isn't the real world, but it is. And that's what makes,
yeah,
your book even better to read, because it's, you suddenly sympathize with these poor children.
Yeah.
I mean, that really, it just, these things happen. I mean, why does a child become mentally ill? Do we know?
No, and that's actually, I mean, what you've hit upon is actually fundamentally the issue with places like this lockdown pediatric psych ward. There are readers who Live to Tell won't be the best book for them, because it's talking about an issue they would just rather ignore. It is easier not to believe that seven-year-olds can be moved to murder or to have the impulse to murder. It's just easier to not believe that. And because of that, you know, this unit I went to will be the first to tell you they don't get enough resources. We are not, as a society, talking about mental illness in young, small, 5, 6, 7-year-old children enough. And that's a huge issue. There's not enough resources. There's not enough respite workers. There's not enough institutions that are qualified to take such children. And there's not enough drugs. There's not enough medical options. And until we as a society are willing to confront some of the stuff and say, hey, we need to fund this, we need to research this, we need to look for answers,
right,
it's going to be marginalized. And the scariest thing that I encountered researching the novel is the number of these kids is actually spiking. And the caretakers I talked to didn't know why. And they're like, there's no research being done to find out why.
I think there's a lot of boredom with children, too. Whether their parents are working, they're at home but alone. They don't have any. A lot of times, they don't have any direction. I mean, what do? They're out playing with their friends, and you know, maybe they're throwing rocks, and things happen that wouldn't necessarily happen. They get out of control. You know, you have a sudden.
This has talked about kids that are organically, like, diagnosably mentally ill. Like, we are seeing a spike in childhood schizophrenia. I mean, as a general rule, doesn't hit until you're a teenager. There is something called childhood schizophrenia, which is like around 3, 4, 5. But all of a sudden, we're seeing many, many more cases of it It's things like bipolar, which again is something you're not supposed to be diagnosed with until, you know, you're 20. All of a sudden, there's five-year-olds that are bipolar, except they're like, well, we can't call them bipolar because for that diagnostic to be used, they have to be 20 and they're five. But, you know, between you and me, they're bipolar.
Right. It's hard to put, you know, I like to put labels on things sometimes because...
Yeah, again, it's like my friend's son. It's not that he did have rage impulse control problems. But for a long time there, until I got it under control, he would talk about that there were phantoms that lived in the mirror. And the phantoms in the mirror told him to kill people. And so for a while, he on his own was covering all the mirrors in the house because he was afraid of the phantom.
Wow.
And he didn't want to do what it said.
That's really...
not a bored kid. That's not a kid that doesn't have engaged caretakers. That has a kid who has brain chemistry that's, you know, misfiring.
Right. And we haven't even talked about what influence TV or movies could have over children, too.
That's
you know?
One of the things that floored my friend as a mother. She did not allow violent things in her house, but her son knew all the violent games and would talk about guns and knives. And she would be like, we didn't allow it. I mean, it was one of the things that flabbergasted her. And I think that's the hardest thing. As parents and as a society, we want to believe we have more power, that if we control the environment, we control the child. And I think one of the things that happens when you get into mental illness is it's internally driven. You can control the environment all you want. It doesn't matter. It's manifesting from the inside. And that's actually really frightening. That's like trying to fight a monster you can never see. And that's, I think, for the parents, what gets to be so overwhelming.
Right. I wonder what scares you. Is there anything that scares you?
I don't like spiders, which is funny because I wrote a whole book with spiders.
Well, how did you write a book about spiders if you hate spiders so much? I mean, was it hard?
I closed my eyes when I wrote those scenes.
Right. I somehow can't imagine that. With all the other stuff that you write, I wouldn't think that's...
I don't know. I'm a parent. I think, actually, I'm afraid of many things, and that's why I write such, you know, intense novels. I'm kind of exploring my own fears as a parent, again, to find the answer. Because if I can talk to the right person and they can give me the right information, then, you know, I can sleep better at night.
There's one of your books that really got me going on your books, really got me hooked for life. And it's called The Next Accident.
Yeah,
and
I remember that one.
It's one of those books that you read and you cannot, I mean, physically, you cannot put this book down once you start reading it. And I tell people that come into the store that a lot. And it's really what got me hooked on your books. I mean, just reading that one. Whatever you did in that book, to me, it was a perfect book.
I had the best time researching that. I got to work with a person whose job is to reconstruct automobile accidents, both for forensic analysis, but also sometimes, you know, he was a consultant, so it was for lawyers in case that, you know, who's to blame. But he actually constructed the accident for the next accident. It's like I gave him my parameters, this is what I'm trying to do, and it needs to look like it really was a car accident, but then later we find out with good reason why the police would have missed it, how it actually was murder, and what the clue to give. And I mean, he was so much fun to work with. He had a million ideas for how to kill people by, you know, vehicle homicide.
And you know what, another thing that you're really good at is every one of your books is different. I never find that I'm thinking, oh, well, she's written about this before. This is just a rehab. You always seem fresh and new. Every book seems that way. I can't imagine how tough that must be to do. I mean,
it's funny. I think that's the natural part for me because I don't want to be bored writing. Because I do think, you know, most writers at a certain point kind of settle in to a kind of story. And I almost feel like to sometimes the detriment of my publisher, I have a tendency to reinvent the wheel each time when, from a marketing and sales perspective, it would be easier for them if I gave them, you know, the old book slightly reformatted. But I get bored. Again, it takes a whole year to write a novel.
Right.
I want to love it. I want to wonder what's going to happen next.
Well, what happens when you're right? You have a really good idea and you're writing the book and it's working real well and all of a sudden you become bored. Then what do you do?
I generally go back to the experts. It means I need something more devious. I'm not actually the world's most clever person, I have to tell you. I really give due credit in my novels to the professionals that help me. I find if you want a really, really twisted, fun, inventive crime, you should talk to a law enforcement officer.
Right.
You know, the FBI agents, Boston detectives, they have really great ideas in their heads for how to, you know, maim, mutilate, murder.
Right.
And if I'm getting bored and I feel the book's flat at all, I haven't asked the right questions, or I need to go back and say, in second thought, this is too routine. What's a better way of committing this crime, or what's a more ingenious way of doing this? And, you know, there's always someone out there that has a good answer for me, and then I get excited again.
Well, that's good that you have so many people that can help you out. I mean, these experts that can help you with the different scenes.
I'm very lucky. Like I said,
I mean, do you have, like, a medical expert? Do you have, like, a lawyer, a doctor on hand to say, you know?
I mix it up each time, depending on what I'm doing. For the book that will come out in March, which is also a Detective Dee Dee Warren novel, we don't have a title just yet, but...
March, so soon?
Yeah, they're going to do it in March. They want to move into the spring.
Oh, that's a cool idea. I like that idea.
And I turned in the book already a couple weeks ago, and they love it and they're happy, so we're good to go for March. But one of the places I've always wanted to go, I don't know what other women fantasize about, but I've always wanted to go to the Body Farm at the University of Tennessee.
Wow.
So a year ago, I got permission to go researching at the Body Farm and deal with the Department of Anthropology, and I have a whole book where it's kind of all about trying to find skeleton remains, identification of skeleton remains, and, you know, I was working with the head of the Department of Anthropology on that, and I just had so much fun. I learned so much.
Did you at all talk to Kathy Reichs? She seems to be an expert on that kind of
stuff. No, I was on a panel with her once, ages and ages and ages ago, but I don't really know her, and I think it would be, I don't know, in poor taste for one suspense author to call another author and say,
that's
hey, you want to... write my novel for me.
So, but I mean, I just wondered if you were curious enough to ask her some things too, but because
no,
you,
I don't, I'm too self-conscious or too intimidated.
You intimidated?
But I love her books. I'm a big fan of her work. So
you're fearless writing, though. I mean, there doesn't seem to be anything that you're afraid to try, and that works for the readers. I think it really helps. Because the reader doesn't know what's coming next, and the reader shouldn't always know what's coming next. Or do you think they should?
No. I like my readers good and surprised.
Yeah.
The process to me is like that. I had some scenes when I was writing this latest book that totally and completely shocked me. There was a great Dee Dee Warren scene in March, and I never saw it coming. It was like my editor's favorite scene. She's like, when did you plan this, and when were you going to tell us? I'm like, I never did. I just sat down to write that day, and that's what came out. And that, when you're an author, is actually the best part of the job, when it really is a little bit magic, and it just makes you feel fresh and young all over again. Like, you know, you haven't done 30 novels. It's like your first book all over again.
I find there's little pockets of real greatness in your novels, too.
Oh, thank you.
A little scenes that really, really work well. And that's important. Because when I read a book, I want scenes like that. I want scenes that, the scene with a little girl, there's scenes with a little girl, and I won't mention anything more than that, just to say they're memorable scenes.
Yeah.
Especially when she opens the door and the little girl's dancing around. That doesn't give anything away, but the little girl's dancing around her room. A little scene like that, which doesn't seem very big, it stays in your head for some reason.
Yeah.
I mean, why I don't know, but I do, there are certain scenes that you never get out of your head.
Thank you. As an author, but, you know, that's what you want to hear, that you touch someone and that they're carrying a little bit of that novel with them.
And it's interesting, though, in your books, when things happen, I always feel bad for the people it happens to, the victims as far as the person who feels bad that it happened, or the nurses or whatever. I always feel for them, too, when I always think, wow, they've been damaged. Are they ever going to be? And you make a point of saying that in your novel, that when something happens, you can't go back.
Yeah.
That's pretty horrifying. The little statement that, you know, something happens and you can't always go back to the way it was before.
No, but I think what Danielle, the nurse in Live to Tell, is trying to teach us is you have to find the new way to go forward, and it's the trying to go back that gets you in trouble. I think personally the one thing I do have that runs across several of my novels is what does it mean to be a survivor? That, you know, something happened that was no fault of your own, like in Danielle's case, her father, you know, killed the entire family but her. And here's the question that's going to haunt her entire life. Is it because he loved her the most or because he hated her the most? And in trying to answer that question, she is like forever doomed. You know,
right.
It's letting it go. It's journeying on. It's finding the new person you are now and embracing that person that kind of holds the key to getting out. And I do think all of my novels at the end of the day are people trying to find their way forward. You know, something happened, and now they need to find their way forward again, which I think is what all of us are trying to do. Hopefully our bad things aren't as dramatic as, you know, a husband or father who murders his family. But, you know, we all take our little hits and our stresses and our disappointments, and, you know, for all the little ways, life isn't what we wanted it to be, and we all just are looking for a way to move forward again.
Well, you have the ultimate job. You're doing exactly what you want to do. You love to write. You even seem to love to do the research. I mean, I talk to some authors who say it's all work.
And, you know, research is my favorite part.
But you get to do the research. And you get to travel, too.
Yeah.
To all these different places, and that must be fun. But when you're sitting there, is it as much fun to do the research as it is sitting down to write the book?
No. It's funny. I mean, I worked 2 years as a research analyst, and the research is the part that I get all jazzed up about. So I love starting a new book, because it's all the fun ideas and the new stuff you just learned and the new great people you just talked to, and it's all so shiny, bright, and new. And then you sit down to write it, and it's like, that's right, you know? And the writing and I have a real love-hate relationship. It's never quite what I pictured in my head, but on the other hand, you have to slog your way through. I'm a big rewriter, so it's like, you know, that first draft is going to be a disappointment to me, but I have to get it down.
Well, isn't it supposed to be? Isn't it supposed to be just a rough draft, and then you work?
People can write them right the first time. That's totally mystifying to me. I've done like 30 books now, and these writers that sit down, and then they write, and that's the finished product. That is my biggest mystery. I do not see how that can be possible.
But Wendy Corsi Straub is one of the people who says she just writes from beginning to end and doesn't do any rewriting.
Yes, you know, I'm deeply envious of those people. I'm like, I just get it down, don't panic, just get it down, don't panic.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know. I'm not going to compare yours and hers because I don't know. I find yours are much more detailed than hers, but don't tell her I said that. But but that's the whole point of authors and readers. There are people who like certain authors more than some because maybe they're not as detailed. Maybe they like that. And maybe, I mean, and you know, it's all different with every reader. Every reader's different. What strikes me as great will not strike the next person as great.
Everyone likes different flavors, you know, of soup at the end of the day.
And my friend emailed me the other day. She says, "Oh, you like all those quote serial killer books?" And I thought, "Well, I don't only like serial killer books. Yes, I'm fascinated by the subject. Yeah, maybe I'm a little true crime. I mean, I hate the true crime section in bookstores, so I'm not fascinated that much with it. But I love to see how they figure it out. That's what really drives me.
I like the problem solving. I think thrillers are fun because they sweep you away. And hoping and live to tell, you do get totally immersed in these three very complex worlds. And how in the world is this all going to come together? And oh my God, there's so many things to be afraid of that I never even knew.
Right.
But now here, all right. And then when your life goes off the rails, this is how you get it back on track.
You need to read Cody McFadden. Have you ever read him?
I read the very first one and loved it, and I've stockpiled the others.
You have to read the second one. Wait, you think the first one was good? The second one is 100 times better than the first one.
Yay.
100.
Well, I'm looking forward to it then.
You must read that book. I have to get your reaction to that book because that book blew me away. It still blows me away when I think about it. It's one of those books.
I like all the fun, interesting books. Like, I love Tess Gerritsen and Kathy Reichs and Karen Slaughter and Harlan Coben and Lee Child.
And the thing is, you're all such nice people, too. I mean, all the people you've mentioned, I've met. And everybody always seems like they're nice people. And
I highly recommend these, you know, Thriller Fest conferences, whatever. Suspense writers are actually pretty nutty and funny and goofy at the end of the day.
And you like meeting the fans, too. You enjoy that. You enjoy it.
For people who write such dark books, you'll never hear so much laughter at a bar as when you got a bunch of suspense authors together. I mean, it's really very funny.
That's true. So, I mean, you really like, I mean, you say that it's difficult sometimes writing, sitting down and writing. Is it a lonely job too much for you sometimes?
No, I'm so lost in my head, I don't notice that part at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Because so many writers will tell me how lonely it seems sometimes.
Well, I mean, and I'm coming home to a very busy family life, so I get over it quickly, apparently.
Right. But but you do it so well, and we've just about run out of time. This has just been such a delight. I mean,
I'm so glad we got to talk.
You're just a nice person, and I really root for you. So, and I'm sure this is going to be another bestseller, Live to Tell. You've had some that went to number one, right?
I've not been number one. It is my goal in life. I've been top five, but I've not been number one.
Really? Well, we'll have to get you to number one on this one somehow.
Thank you. That would be, you make that happen. That would be the
Now you've got me determined to do it. I'm just wondering what the best way to do that is.
Yeah, that's what we'd like to know. If you could blueprint that.
Now we just want to
make a lot of money.
I just want to mention more. The next book's going to be called Save Me. That's the one you were mentioning.
Yeah, but it won't be called Save Me because it turns out the very gorgeous and talented Lisa Scottolini already has that title.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
We just found out ourselves a week ago. So it would be very confusing because she's also spraying to have two books out with that title. And it was hers first, and her artwork's done, and ours is not. So that was not a problem.
They really do that, huh? That's interesting.
Once they know what they're doing, they've moved. I mean, we were still working on Live to Tell, so packaging, marketing, and cover art hadn't gotten to the spring book because I just turned it in 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And they're definitely ahead in the process than we are. And well, like I said, we all play very well together at the end of the day. That's not a thing to get bent out of shape about. It's just like, oh, whoops, shucky darns, we missed that one. But there's good titles out there, so
you'll find another one, whatever it's going to be.
If you know one, send it our way.
So right now it's untitled. Well, this has been a delight. I really appreciate this so much.
Thank you very much, David.
And the book, again, is called Live to Tell. It's out from Bantam Books in all your bookstores now. And we will talk to you next time.
Thank you very much.